Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Harrison in Providence. A new report finds that while deaths from prescription drug overdose have doubled in Rhode Island, the state has implemented many of the measures experts say can prevent those deaths. Rhode Island Public Radio's healthcare reporter Kristen Gourlay has more.
The Trust for America's Health surveyed all 50 states on what steps they're taking to prevent prescription drug abuse. The Trust is a nonpartisan think tank focused on disease prevention. Its report ranked Rhode Island near the top at 13th in drug overdose deaths, with a rate of more than 15 deaths per 100,000 people. That's more than double the rate 10 years ago. But on a list of 10 strategies it recommends for combating prescription drug abuse and overdoses, Rhode Island scored a promising 8. Some of those strategies include a Good Samaritan law, which provides some immunity for people who call authorities for help for someone experiencing a possible overdose. The Ocean State missed the mark on having a law that requires pharmacies to ask for ID before filling some prescriptions, and on access to an overdose prevention drug called Narcan. Kristen Gourlay, Rhode Island Public Radio.
Former State Treasurer Frank Caprio is running for his old job, and as Rhode Island Public Radio's Flo Jonick reports, he's rejoining the Democratic Party.
After disaffiliating from the Democratic Party and toying with the idea of running as a Republican, Frank Caprio has decided to run for his old job as General Treasurer as a Democrat. Announcing his candidacy at a Federal Hill pizzeria, he explained his reasoning.
For over 24 years, I've either held office or ran for office as a Democrat. Going back to being 18 years old, I think I voted in every primary general election as a Democrat, and I look forward to continuing that streak.
If elected, Caprio says he will focus on reducing pension fund investment fees and funneling that money back into cost of living raises for public employees and teachers.
The fees now, based on what information has been given out by the Treasurer's office, are about $70 million. When I was there, they were at the lower end of the spectrum in the country, closer to $20 million. I believe that that $50 million difference could be used to fashion a solution to the pension lawsuit that's currently in the courts.
Caprio says he'll run against anyone, even current State Treasurer Gina Raimondo, who is mulling a run for governor. Flo Jonick, Rhode Island Public Radio.
Retired U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor speaks this morning at Roger Williams University Law School. She's scheduled to appear alongside Judge Bruce Celia of the 1st U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Sandra Day O'Connor was the first woman to serve on the nation's highest court. She was appointed by President Ronald Reagan. After her visit to Roger Williams University, O'Connor is scheduled to make a stop at the Highlander Charter School in Providence, where she will promote her initiative aimed at improving civics education. It's called iCivics. And layoffs are expected at the Providence Journal after the newspaper fell short of its target for reducing positions through buyouts. Providence Newspaper Guild President John Hill says 12 workers have agreed to take the buyout. 4 of them are on the news side, and 8 are in advertising. The Journal had hoped to eliminate 30 positions with the buyouts. Hill says he expects the newspaper to move ahead with a not-yet-determined number of layoffs. Bristol is home to the only law school in Rhode Island at Roger Williams University. The law school is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. As part of Rhode Island Public Radio's series, One Square Mile, looking at Bristol, I sat down with Law School Dean David Logan to ask about some of the challenges the school is facing today. David Logan, thanks for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure.
So law schools around the country are seeing a drop in applications and enrollment numbers since the recession. It's harder for students to get jobs, and law school is pretty expensive. What are you seeing at Roger Williams Law School?
We're part of the national trend. Our market is national. We have applicants from all over the country and even international applicants, so it would be surprising if what's going on nationally wouldn't be happening at Roger Williams.
And your class this year is actually smaller than it's been in previous years.
It is the smallest it's been since I've been here. It's 115. We were at low 150s last year. It's important to put in context that we really were riding a national almost bubble in applications from 2003 to 2010. There was hardly a law school that didn't have an opportunity to get larger, and that bubble has burst. And so consequently, lower number of applicants competing for the same number of seats, it means you're going to have to get smaller or you're going to have to get weaker students. And we have made the decision to try and keep quality up and take the revenue hit by getting smaller.
Now, one of the things that you're doing at Roger Williams to attract more students is to focus on real-world experience, and this is responding to that complaint that law firms often have, that lawyers coming fresh out of law school don't have enough practical skills. So describe what you're doing right now at Roger Williams to make sure your students get the hands-on experience in the legal field that they need before they graduate.
We are committed to turning out practice-ready lawyers. We follow a traditional curriculum for the first year and a half. It's very similar to what students will do at any other law school. They learn the theory of the law. They learn substantive law in key areas. But then starting in their fourth semester through their sixth, they have options to learn how to apply that law they learned in their what we call the doctrinal classes in skills settings. And we've really ramped it up in the last year. Most law schools are really trying to tighten their belts. We've added an opportunity for students to work in in-house counsel offices, so at CVS, the Red Sox, IDC, Textron, students can learn from corporate lawyers. We opened last month our first small business clinic so we can start teaching lawyers who want to do transactional work. And then we now have just approved a semester in practice, which is going to enable students to take their entire either fall or spring semester of their third year in practice, either in a judge's chambers or in a law office or a government office. Not just in Rhode Island. We expect our students to be able to take this idea and go back to where they come from, where they might have connections, the family roots, take their last semester essentially distance learning.
David Logan, there's another thing that sets Roger Williams apart. It also relates to this kind of hands-on education that we've been talking about, but there's a focus at Roger Williams Law School on pro bono work. And that's work that lawyers do free of charge, at least until their clients receive some sort of financial settlement or award. But students at Roger Williams are doing quite a bit of community work. What are some of the projects they're working on right now?
Well, it's based upon something that came up early in our history, and the faculty decided that we wanted to have all of our students do some pro bono work, not for credit, not for pay, while they're law students. So we are one of about a dozen schools that require a substantial number of hours of pro bono work performed by students as a graduation requirement. A student may be giving talks on the rights of immigrants at a community base in South Providence. They might help a nonprofit become incorporated and therefore begin to take advantage of tax advantages. Many of our students blow by that 50-hour requirement at the end of their first year and put in hundreds of hours of work, again, uncompensated, and again, not for academic credit.
Do you think that that experience is having much effect on the types of careers that your students choose to go into?
Undoubtedly. There are many students who came into law school not thinking that public service was something they really wanted to do. But when you're helping some people make the transition from the ACI to civilian life, when you're helping somebody make the transition from an immigrant to citizenship status, that's really empowering to you, regardless of how much help you give to the client. You are a better person, and I think in the end going to be a better lawyer and more attractive to employers for having done that.
I'm speaking with David Logan, Dean of the Law School at Roger Williams University. David Logan, how would you say the law school's reputation has evolved over the last 20 years?
Well, we were a startup 20 years ago, and the folks that came in the first year did it really on faith. And terrific leadership in the early years got us the all-important accreditation by the American Bar Association in the minimum time required. We got it in 3 years. And then what really has changed is the numbers. The number that you most look at to determine the quality of a program is bar pass rate. And our students, our graduates, have been knocking the ball out of the park in the last 5 years in that regard, consistently in the 80s and 90%, which is nationally very substantial.
Now, as the only law school in the state of Rhode Island, what do you see as the biggest impact that the school has had on this state?
There is no doubt that the breadth and depth of public debate about issues has been positively influenced by the law school. I'll just give you two examples. One of them was the very contentious debate early when I got here about separation of powers. The university, through its law review, published articles on separation of powers, and Carl Bogus from our faculty was one of the leaders through Common Cause in that effort that was ultimately successful in the constitutional amendment a few years ago.
And we should remind listeners that separation of powers refers to, maybe you can explain it best.
You have a sort of a choice as to how you're going to divide up government between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislative branch. And Rhode Island historically has been a legislative dominant state, the only one really in the country. It required a change of the Constitution to give the governor some power And without the law school and the intellectual power of the law school, that wouldn't have happened. The other is we've been very influential in changing the way in which judges are selected in Rhode Island. And Michael Yanosky from our faculty has been a champion of merit selection of judges.
Do you see an effect, David Logan, on the ethics in Rhode Island and ethics in the judiciary?
We've certainly came out of a rough patch on judicial ethics. Before I got here, we lost two straight chief justices, and we're lucky enough to have the late Joe Weisberger step in and immediately raise the bar, which has now been continued by Frank Williams and by Paul Sotell at the chief justice level. Terrific judges up and down. So, yes, the judiciary has gotten stronger. There's no doubt about that. I can't prove a cause and effect between a law school and ethical behavior, but I do think that there is an impact, at least sort of in the atmosphere, that if you're behaving badly, the law school might be in a position, and people in the law school, not the law school, but faculty in particular, to shed light on that. And as Brandeis said years ago, you know, sunlight's the best disinfectant. And if you have people willing to write op-ed pieces criticizing the powerful and what they do in Rhode Island, then I think it is a check on government. I wouldn't say necessarily ethics, but check on self-interested bad behavior.
Let's shift gears here for just a minute and talk about the community where Roger Williams is located, the town of Bristol. That's the focus of the series we're doing here on Rhode Island Public Radio. So, Roger Williams Law School Dean David Logan, what's your favorite Bristol story?
I always love going to the Lobster Pot. It's been around apparently a very long time. There's a lot more interesting different options now than there were back in the day, but still a lobster roll at the Lobster Pot can't be beat on a sunny day with a view of the bay.
Well, David Logan, Dean of the Law School at Roger Williams University, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Education reporting on Rhode Island Public Radio is funded in part by a grant by the Rhode Island Foundation, Rhode Island's only community foundation, and New England Institute of Technology's Center for Technology and Industry.
Nothing drives organizers of the Bristol 4th of July parade crazier than hearing a reporter describe it as the oldest in the country. It's not. What is true is what's on the town's welcome sign, which reads, "Welcome to Bristol, home of America's oldest 4th of July celebration." You see, it hasn't always been marching bands and drum and bugle corps. The tradition started in 1785 with what was called a patriotic exercise, basically the reading of speeches at a local church. Bristol Parade historian Richard Simpson, author of the book Independence Day, How the Day is Celebrated in Bristol, Rhode Island, says the parade may have morphed out of these patriotic exercises.
Through my research, what I came to understand from all the documents I was reading, that as the town population grew, people were meeting at different corners, different places throughout the town to get together to go to the patriotic exercises at the Congregational Church. So actually, it was an informal parade. And who knows, maybe at that time, the musicians who were going to play at the exercises went along with the people who were, you know, the citizens going to the exercises. And so the town council figured, well, it was about time to put some order to this, and they appointed a chief marshal to make the thing more coherent.
According to Simpson, since 1785, there have been only 8 times when a parade wasn't held. The most common cause is economic distress. But in 1881, it was canceled over the assassination of President James Garfield. The town's population of roughly 22,000 more than quadruples on the 4th of July. And at 10:30 sharp, the parade steps off from the corner of Chestnut and Hope Streets. The 2.5-mile route can take 4 hours to complete. In recent years, spectators have had to wait until 6 a.m. to stake out prime viewing spots along the parade route. Bristolians, hospitable as they are, got tired of people camping out in their front yards, according to parade historian Richard Simpson.
That kind of ticked off the people who actually lived along the parade route because they felt that the grassy area in front of the house belonged to them, and they wanted it for their own guests. But these people were coming from, well, actually all over the country, the Northeast anyway, and staking out claims.
The Independence Day celebration in Bristol actually begins on June 14th, Flag Day. In the 3 weeks between the two holidays, there are band concerts, baseball games, beauty pageants, and a town ball. Planning for the parade goes on all year. Dick DeVault has been on the 4th of July committee for 10 years, the last two as chairman.
How much of a time commitment is it?
That varies from member to member. For me, it was a full-time job because I'm retired. Okay, and since I'm retired, I can do a lot more than a person who's not.
And unlike some communities which have had to scale back festivities for lack of help, DeVault says they have had no trouble finding volunteers for the 4th of July celebration in Bristol.
This is a long-term celebration. It means a lot to the town of Bristol. These are my opinions. People have been a part of it in many cases since they were very, very small. It's been here since 1785, so I guess the idea of keeping it going means a lot to a lot of people.
The parade has not been without its mishaps. In 1972, the parade committee invited then-Navy Secretary John Chafee, only to disinvite him later when he quit his job to run for the U.S. Senate. It was a long-standing policy of the 4th of July committee to invite only incumbent office holders to march. Parade historian Richard Simpson says Chafee took the rebuff gracefully, but didn't stay away from the parade.
He marched the sidewalk back and forth, shaking hands with his friends and supporters, and so he did all right. In the end, he was elected senator.
In the bicentennial year of 1976, the parade had to be rerouted after a fight broke out between marchers and spectators.
There were a group of toughs that kind of occupied a vacant lot down on Hope Street opposite the harbor. The heat and the beer got to them, and people were throwing fireworks into the marchers. So there was a group of marchers, I think they were from Canada, they broke ranks, went into the crowd of tough guys, and a fight ensued.
The parade not only draws spectators from around the country, but brings native Bristolians home as well. Each year, a prize is given out to the native Bristolian who has traveled the farthest to attend the festivities, parade historian Richard Simpson.
The person who comes the furthest to be home on the 4th of July receives a flag that is flown over the nation's capital. And people have come from Guam. Hawaii is, oh my gosh, that's nearby, you know, when we start talking about the farthest distance. Usually veterans are coming home. You know, they'll take their leave to come back to Bristol at that time. But sometimes citizens who are, you know, have jobs in foreign countries will come home.
Perhaps a prize should have also been given this year to 89-year-old Betty Grimo, a native Bristolian who has been attending the parade since she was a Girl Scout. Bristol is proud of its Independence Day tradition. It not only draws locals closer, but is a boon to the local economy. And its longevity has earned it the moniker America's Most Patriotic Town. Flo Jonick, Rhode Island Public Radio.